Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. You can find information on this specific subtype or your subtype, as well as all our podcast episodes on SFA's website, www.curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Thanks for listening. On this episode, we sit down with Jenny Sage, a parent of a pediatric sarcoma survivor, Gracie. After Gracie was diagnosed with SickDux 4 in 2022, Jenny became a quote-unquote cancer mom, and she shares her perspective on what it means to advocate for your child, as well as others in the sarcoma and pediatric cancer community. We talk about what it's like to support your child and your entire family through a sarcoma diagnosis, the importance of setting time aside to process the emotional load, and tangible ways to help others in a similar position based off of Jenny's lived experience. We also talk about the impactful advocacy work Jenny and Gracie have participated in on Capitol Hill to take a stand for the pediatric sarcoma population. This episode dives into the pediatric sarcoma perspective, one that is often misunderstood and needs different support, resources, and treatments than adults. And we're so grateful to Jenny for sharing this honest account of what that experience is like. Let's dive in. Welcome back to Sarcoma Stories, or if this is your first time listening, welcome to the Sarcoma Stories podcast. I'm Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
And I'm Brandy. I'm your other host.
And today we have Jenny Sage joining us. So Jenny, would you like to introduce yourself?
I am Jenny Sage, and I'm 43.
And Jenny, we're here to talk about your journey with sarcoma, which really also means your daughter's journey with sarcoma. So would you like to tell us a little bit about your daughter, Gracie?
Yeah, Gracie was 9 years old when she was diagnosed with sarcoma. She one night told me that she found a lump in her chest. And it's one of those things as a mom where I feel like you should always trust your gut. I looked at it. It looked a little bit weird. I touched it thinking it might be a cyst and realized very quickly that it probably wasn't. And so we went to our pediatrician who, thank goodness, decided not to sit and wait and watch, because I think if he did that, she probably wouldn't be here. And so he sent us to get an ultrasound, and which quickly led to an MRI. So I have definitely learned how quickly things happen when they know something's potentially wrong. After we got the MRI back, that was the first time I saw the word sarcoma. However, we were reassured that it actually wasn't sarcoma, which was really interesting. And I had a conversation with a surgeon, and basically in the 3 weeks that all of this took place, the bump on her chest had gone from the size of a dime to a size of a quarter. So it was growing really fast. And even though he thought it wasn't sarcoma, he went over and looked at the MRI. I said to him, whatever it is, I'd like to get it out because it's growing quickly. And so we booked Gracie for an MRI. And about 30 minutes into her surgery, my husband and I got pulled into the side room, which was never a good sign, which I know now. And so at that point, we were told that it was highly likely that she had cancer. And they weren't exactly sure what kind. We actually started our journey at a different hospital than we ended up being treated at. And because of the rarity of her cancer, I think they knew it was sarcoma, but they weren't sure exactly what kind. And so at our initial hospital, they had given us not necessarily two diagnoses, but had said it was probably either alveolar soft part sarcoma, and then a second one that they didn't actually even give a name. And so we stayed at that hospital through her PET scan and discussed treatment options. And at the time, thinking back now, I know how naive I was when they were talking about the alveolar soft part sarcoma, telling me that it wasn't treatable with chemo. I was like, oh, well, that's good. She would just do radiation and that's a better option. But she had to have a full body PET scan also. We met with another hospital who was a sarcoma center, and immediately after leaving that appointment, knew that's really where we needed to be. Her cancer was local. And so it took about 3 more weeks for us to know exactly what her cancer was. So it actually took 3 hospitals. And I think more of it, honestly, was just because of the rarity of it. The time just trying to figure it out was really what it was. And then when we were told that Gracie had a very rare type of cancer, undifferentiated sarcoma, and then she has a gene positive fusion, the CDUX4, I feel like our worlds kind of fell apart. Our doctor told us that because of the rarity of it, there was no known treatment protocol in the world for her. And so we kind of went to next steps. Luckily, in her surgery, they were able to get the tumor out. They didn't get clear margins at the time. But once we made the decision to move forward with chemo, they went back in and resected her tumor, fully got clear margins, and then we moved forward to treatment.
I just want to confirm that both of the places you went to were sarcoma centers.
Yeah. And as a parent, you want to be sure when you're facing your child's mortality that while there may not be no known treatment protocol, that they're going to try. Our doctor is incredible. And he said to me, he said, "Jenny, we will always try. We will always try something." And I know that he called multiple doctors across the country to come up with our treatment plan.
So Jenny, this doctor comes up with your treatment plan. What is that treatment plan? Can you tell us about what that treatment plan ended up being?
Well, there's, I want to say maybe 6 drugs-ish that are used to treat kids. You know, Gracie had ifosfamide and doxorubicin. And even when I talk to people about those drugs and the long-term side effects, they have no idea. And most of these drugs were created over 40 years ago. It's unfortunate. And truly, it is limited what these kids have access to.
Yeah. As a pediatric parent, what do you want people to understand about those differences as somebody who's seen it up close with their child?
As a parent, when people talk about kids and they talk about them being resilient, it is one of like the most frustrating things to me, because what is represented in the media or just in general is it's a lot of kids with no hair, smiling, getting to do all of the fun things. And we also saw a different side of that where we were kind of alienated from people because of experience that we had. But it's highly traumatic. It's highly isolating. It affects the entire family. And I think people need to know that while they quote the 85 survival rate, what people don't understand is after 5 years, you're deemed a survivor. But that doesn't mean that you're actually going to survive. These kids end up with long-term major health implications from the treatment that they had.
I think that is a huge misconception for pediatric patients that, okay, they survive and get to grow up and have this life. But as you've said, there can be some serious consequences because of the treatments available to pediatric patients. And that needs to be accounted for.
Yeah. And I don't think people truly understand like what those are. And speaking from experience for Gracie, we just had her first survivorship appointment and our hospital is incredible. We have a dietitian. There's someone that works with her with school and all these other resources. And they give you a notebook. And I remember this happened to us in December. And I looked at the notebook and I looked at our nurse practitioner in survivorship. And I was like, I don't think I want to read that. And she's like, you really should read that. And I just remember when we were initially diagnosed and we were offered kind of 2 treatment plans in our circumstances, Gracie is a twin and we went through in vitro to have the twins and we actually almost lost her at 2 weeks old. She had apnea, they were preemies. And I just remember crying to the doctor and saying like, I don't understand. I fought to give her life. Now I'm fighting to save her life. And 2 years out of treatment, not that it gets easier, but it's not as consuming. But the survivorship appointment really was heavy for me. And I didn't let Gracie read the notebook. You know, kids reprocess trauma and experiences at different ages. And I just read it about a week ago and it, you know, whether it's infertility or heart failure, some different chemos cause hearing loss, you know, people just don't understand that this is a lifelong journey for kids. And as a parent, there are moments where you're reminded and you are kind of shook to your core again. And that was one for me where I was like, for about 2 days, I was kind of like just sad because I'm like, this really is forever. Like, she might be okay now. You're not only worried about the cancer coming back and her surviving that, but all of what could happen. And I think that's also what people don't understand.
I have to say that that has become a theme. I think this is our fifth that it's almost every single conversation we have for this podcast, that those exact words come up. People think we are over it and everything goes back to normal. And it doesn't.
Really, it doesn't. And I can tell you, as a parent to a child that had cancer, you're literally just putting your head down and getting through it. I can tell you that I didn't feel for the entire time through diagnosis until when she was declared no evidence of disease and we were done with treatment. And I, at that point, is when I crashed. The community and your friends and your family show up and support you in incredible ways. And that does start to wane because everybody has their normal life. And for me, almost after cancer treatment was harder than going through it because I felt like outside of my family, I didn't have anybody. And outside of cancer moms or other people, even meeting you, Tasha, like people that understand like what it's like. I mean, I've lost good friends. I've had friends tell me I was a terrible friend. It actually is really hurtful because it's way harder than people have any idea. And it's not just the physical journey, but it's also the emotional journey. I have been in therapy. I've done EMDR. They told me I had PTSD. My Grace's younger sister is currently in play therapy 2 years after because she was just 4 when Gracie was diagnosed. And she's also reprocessing what could happen. She's very mature for her age. And even Gracie didn't talk about death or dying until a year after she was cancer-free. So she's also reprocessing. So it's more than anyone could ever imagine. And it really doesn't stop.
The way that I've heard pediatric parents talk about the experience is very similar to how, it's not the same, but it's similar to how I hear adult patients talk about the experience. And it's almost like there's two patients, quote unquote, like there's the pediatric patient and then you as the parent process these emotions in a way that a patient does. Like you are going through it with your child. Not only are you caretaking and doing all of the responsibilities and managing the appointments, but you are processing some very traumatic emotions and experiences.
And you have to allow yourself to be able to feel that. And I feel like I kind of learned that the hard way. I mean, it was really important for me to prioritize my other kids and my family to make sure that they were okay. Gracie has a twin and Izzy. I think that that's really important. And I think that part is what people don't understand is that after treatment, it's like all of a sudden your world crashes. And at one point, I remember saying to another cancer mom, I'm like, is something wrong with me? Why do I feel worse now than I did before? And anyone that reaches out to me now, I tell them, I wish I had started therapy way sooner than I did. But you have to allow yourself time to feel. And I think, especially being a parent of a child with rare cancer, every holiday, every birthday, you are overdoing everything because you're like, could this be her last? Is this going to be her last? And I remember her Valentine's Day. She was no evidence of disease in December, her Valentine's Day in February. And she never had a boyfriend. And she's almost 10. And I sent flowers to the house anonymously because I'm like, if she never has a boyfriend or she talk about getting married or having kids and you don't know. And I think that the people who want you to be normal, that's what they don't understand. It's like you are living these emotions and living this life that is so surreal that at any moment it could be taken away. And just this Christmas was the first time that, not that I felt normal, but I've been working through the trauma of all of those things. And also realizing that you at some point have to go back to living. You can't live your life in these big ways forever. And so it took me 2 years to get to the place where I didn't do things every holiday. Halloween, my husband's like, why are you decorating so much for Halloween? And I'm like, what if it's her last? And he would look at me like I'm crazy. But that as a parent is what you worry about. They made it through treatment and not all kids make it through treatment. And you want to give them the world. And you asked me what I would want people to know. And for the people that have pulled away that think that I'm different or I'm distant or I'm not a good friend or whatever, it's not true. This is what I'm thinking about. I'm not thinking about you. I'm thinking about my family, my kids, and memories, being present.
And also, you're so focused on, as a parent, trying to make decisions for your child, because it's on you as the parents to make the decisions for these young kids who are going through it, who, as much as you may want to bring them into the decision-making process and explain to them what's happening and have them be a part of the journey, sometimes it's just too much for them to even understand and to even process. So now you are focused on doing everything you can to make decisions and move in the right direction for what could be best for your child. And that, and the emotions that go with it, that's just all consuming. When you were going through it, what resources did you use?
Gosh, first and foremost, I think the first resource I had were two people who, one I went to high school with and one that was actually a teammate of mine in college whose children had pediatric cancer. Because quite honestly, especially being the rarest of rare, I genuinely didn't know where to start. And as much as they tell you not to Google, I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know what sarcoma was. I thought it was better to have radiation. I thought it was okay to not have chemo. I really fundamentally did not understand. And luckily, I found the Sarcoma Foundation's website that was extremely helpful for me. And also a local foundation that I'm on the board of now because of the way that they supported me. Really, between those resources and other parents, that was all that I knew to do, because Gracie subtype, I mean, it was so rare. I couldn't find people that were alive in the beginning. And then I actually found a Facebook group with people who have what she has. And there's maybe 6 or 7 people that are alive and have lived 4+ years. So I really clung to that as like hope. Instagram, I mean, it's kind of sad that that's what you do, but you find comfort and connection with people who have gone through it. That's really what I clung to.
Something I always say too is, even as you mentioned, maybe there's just a few people that are even alive 4 years later, even if there's a 1% chance, someone has to be in the 1%, or we wouldn't have the 1%. So for me, there's always hope. I also want to focus on your advocacy. We met you at our Hill Day last year, where you and Gracie attended our first inaugural Hill Day, which was really important for us, as we talked about even then, of putting sarcoma on the map, on the hill, right, as a rare cancer. So we felt very strongly about making our voice heard in front of legislators, and also because we span so many age groups, and it really it affects each group in so many different ways. How did you, and when did you get involved in advocacy?
The irony in all this is, naturally, I'm someone who is very philanthropic. I always have been. I've always liked to give my time to charity. And the twins, where they were born was the hospital that actually treated Gracie for cancer too. And when Gracie almost passed away at 2 weeks old, I remember riding in the ambulance and saying, God, if you let her live, I'll do whatever I can to pay it forward. And so, like, I have pictures dating back at this hospital where we did Band-Aid drives, we did toy drives, we did all of these things. And then the irony is we landed there 8 years later. And so I immediately threw myself into it. I am someone who is not good being idle. So I found a local foundation who focused on rare cancers. And even looking back at that now, I realized people throw the term rare out easily too. I didn't realize at the time, but I realize now that raising money for rare cancer means that I'm going to be helping other people with bigger sarcoma types first. You know, Grace's cancer is so rare, but someone was kind enough to start a GoFundMe. And I'm someone who has a really hard time accepting help. And we got to a point where we had enough money to pay our out-of-pocket for 2 years, plus whatever we needed. I think we raised over $40,000 just from family and friends wanting to support us. And then as we got farther along, it didn't feel right not doing for others, quite honestly. So Gracie and I would do silly stuff on Instagram. We started this campaign called Skip It Saturdays, and we'd ask people to skip their coffee, skip their donut, skip their appetizer, and donate to pediatric cancer. I think we've raised like almost $90,000 just by doing stuff like that. And so we made sure that every time we show up at scans, we ask for money on Instagram and support families with gift certificates. And then I became part of a local sarcoma foundation here in Charlotte. So they help fund prosthetics for people nationally and actually internationally. So we're actually trying right now to fund a whole sarcoma specific project at the hospital we were treated at.
You and Gracie have really woven in advocacy and fundraising into your daily lives in a way. I think sometimes when people hear advocacy, they think like, it needs to always be big. Like it always needs to be a huge effort that takes a lot of planning consistently. Something you and Gracie are so good at is finding creative ways to just make it a part of your lifestyle and your new normal. And so with scans every couple of months, like the Skip It Saturdays on those times and finding all these creative ways, what was it like for you to take that to the next level on Hill Day? Because I think there are a lot of people who are interested in doing that and kind of want to know what it's like going from these small moments to a larger effort like Hill Day.
I have to say that the Hill Day experience for me was probably the most powerful experience I've had, quite honestly, because when you think of research for cancer in general, it takes a lot of money to move the needle. So advocacy is really where we're going to create change. And so having the conversations with the people on the Hill Day and having Gracie be a part of that, I feel like was also really impactful for them to hear it from a kid. But I'm really looking forward to this year's, and I hope that we can encourage people to come and join us, because that movement is really what's going to change access for sarcoma patients in so many different ways.
You have a saying, just do something. There's always a way to do something. So what does that mean to you and Gracie?
It really, in these highs and lows of going through all of this, when Grace finished treatment, it felt like, not that the support fully ends, right? But obviously people go back to their day-to-day life. And so my ask of people has always been to just do something. And if it doesn't have to be financial, it can be giving your time. It can be showing up. It can be sharing a post just to create awareness, because people don't understand like how powerful that is or how much reach you can have sometimes on accident. That kind of happened to us, but just do something. And I think for me, especially as a parent where there's limited research and there's limited treatment options, join us in however you can. Share my post, share somebody else's post, share a foundation's post, or go volunteer at a 5K. You know, just do something to help us, because from a pediatric standpoint, it really is driven by parents. There is no one stopping these moms. And I know that there's some dads too, so I don't mean it like that. But when it comes to your kids, you're willing to do whatever it takes to move the needle.
I like what you said, Tasha, that advocacy, everyone thinks it's a big thing, or they think it's public policy alone. Advocacy is so many things. And there are so many different ways people reflect advocacy. People can be a part of and advocate in so many different ways. One of the things we talk about in a lot of these conversations too is just support that people receive. And you touched on this a little bit of getting support, but then it wanes after a while. Right. For the people who might want to provide support and don't know what to do, what suggestions would you give them?
Gosh, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about, that just do something. I will say that I learned so much about how to show up for people, whether not even just pediatric cancer. I think I used to show up in the way of asking somebody, what can I do for you? How can I help you? And I would text and I would call because I wanted them to feel like I was supporting them. And then when this happened, being on the receiving end of that, it is so overwhelming for people to constantly reach out. And I don't mean that in the way that it sounds, but you're drowning, because what you said, Brandy, where you don't know what you're doing, you're trying to advocate for your child's life and you want to make sure that you're making the best decisions. People were wanting to do meal trains. And in my mind, I didn't want to say no, but I have three kids and nobody eats the same thing. And I wasn't sure if we were going to be at the hospital or if we were going to be home. And I was like, gosh, that's so nice, but you're spending your time and your money. And so our good friend started a kind of the same idea, but with gift cards. And so they showed up with Target and Amazon and gas and grocery, filet, gift cards, and also gift cards for Gracie's siblings. So if somebody had my kids, it wasn't a burden for them. They could take them to the movies or they could take them to Chick-fil-A or take them somewhere and it us not also have to worry about it being a financial burden. And then I think the other thing is really thinking, what can you take off somebody's plate? Do they have an animal? Can you help with the animal? Do they have another child? Can you do play dates or take them to practice? Can you cut their grass? Can you hire a cleaner? The day-to-day that becomes hard and you don't necessarily know when things are going to go down. With gift cards, it's safe too, because no matter where you are, you can use them, which I think is really helpful. That's what I tell people now is show up in a way that you know you can help without asking, because people aren't going to say no.
One of the things I think I got from that is it's the simple things. It's just that people really need just somebody saying, hey, I got that.
The other thing I'll say too is we're lucky to have a village. We could not have survived without my mom and dad, my mother and father-in-law, my sister and her fiance. My sister sent phone chargers and all the things we needed for the hospital. I didn't have to ask. Things just kind of showed up. Even offering to be the person who, if the child has a sibling that someone could call in an emergency and be like, hey, can you take my kid? I have to go to the hospital.
You talked about the other children and mm-hmm. the impact that it's had on them. How did you manage to be there for your child who's going through it, but also knowing that you still have other children at home that need your attention?
I feel like as a parent, you're always going to feel like you didn't do it well. I think not that I necessarily would have done anything different. In our circumstance, Grace was 9. She has a twin brother that's 9. Izzy was barely 4. And so very different age dynamics. And some people showed up in ways that if they sent Grace things, they also sent stuff for her siblings, which I think is also really important because, you know, a pediatric cancer patient gets experiences or gifts. Stuff was showing up at our house daily. And so the people that included them, I will say that was really helpful and also a great bit of advice. But gosh, I feel like this is something that was an opportunity for me. You try and spend one-on-one time with your other kids. Gracie and I, she wanted me to sleep with her. So I slept with her for 18 months. And Izzy was born a year before COVID, so she was super clingy to me. And so honestly, what I would say is give yourself grace. You're doing the best that you can. And I think what I did learn as well, I may not be able to give somebody an entire day. If I could, like for my littlest one, give her an hour of undivided attention. I put my phone away. We weren't with Gracie. We had to be careful about germs, but just intentional time is meaningful too. And I think if you have older children, Jackson definitely understood what was going on, but I definitely have tried to overcompensate, I would say, after treatment to make him feel special. And that's something that I have to live with because you can't give everybody all your time. And I would say that's the other thing with your friends not understanding. Like, people take things personal and it's not personal. I'm trying to take care of my kid with cancer, keep, you know, work, and my work was incredible, and give my other two kids individual time and time together and my husband. And that's all consuming. You have to give yourself grace and know that you're literally in survival mode doing the absolute best that you can. Well, you're always going to have something that you could have done differently and better, but you did the best that you can with what you knew at the time. And you have to be okay with that.
Yeah. It's such a multifaceted experience. Like you've said, it's just, there are so many moving parts and so many things that you have to consider.
Yeah, it's a lot. And I think the other thing with kids is there's the whole school aspect too. And that's like a whole nother can of worms. And I just have to say that we have just been so blessed and lucky with the people that came into our lives. And Grace's teacher, we put the twins back in the same classroom. Her teacher didn't have to teach her virtually, but her teacher did. And I come in and find Gracie trying to do homework and she was like passed out. She was so tired from chemo with her computer in her hand. And but her teacher that year was just so incredible and patient and gave all of her personal time to make sure Gracie stayed on task, and Grace pretty much made straight A's, missing school. We owe a lot to a lot of people for really supporting us in the ways that were just incredible.
Glad you mentioned that, because I think that's another part of the experience with pediatric cancer that isn't talked about enough. We talk about this in the AYA community a lot, of life being interrupted, but that's very true for pediatric patients too, and their parents. To be in school and have a year of that interrupted for you to get treatment is a very real thing.
Yeah.
That's another awareness piece of this entire multifaceted situation, is it's not just keeping your kid alive. It's in the hopes that you are able to keep them alive, that you are able to continue their education, continue all these other parts of their life. And that goes into the entire playbook of pediatric cancer.
And I think it's one of those things too, that we were really fortunate. Gracie was able to zoom in, so the kids saw her. Gracie didn't like to wear hats or wigs or anything. No hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes. That was just her. And she owned it, and they got to see her like that. And then Child Life at our hospital offered to go to school with Gracie or without. It was up to Gracie, but they sat in the room with the fourth graders and let them ask questions, like explain to them what cancer was. When Grace was first diagnosed, her first question wasn't whether or not she was going to die at 9. Her first question was, am I contagious? So they sat in the room, they explained what chemo was. They gave the kids an opportunity to ask her the questions instead of having to ask Gracie. And I feel like that made the transition for her back to school really easy. Even in survivorship, you know, they track with her, you know, cognitive, you know, all of the things. So there's a lot of moving parts, I will say, because right now, Gracie, while she's doing really good in some ways, is having some long-term cognitive issues. Reading has become hard for her. And so while she still makes really good grades, we're still trying to get her cognitive testing, stuff like that. People just don't know. So things just become harder. Her short-term memory isn't as good. There's a lot of ways that you have to keep asking questions and advocating.
When you're in school, when you're in the hospital for weeks at a time, getting your chemotherapy or getting treatment, how do you maintain school for the child? All of these life functions that still have to occur for the child.
Right. Yeah. And I was concerned, I mean, in the beginning, because Gracie, she would Zoom for 1 hour a day. Her teacher offered up 504 plan. So that's where you have to ask the questions and advocate, whether you're out of school or in school. So when she was out of school, in these plans, you really have to include everything. You can get class notes. You can get all of these extra resources. Time, concentration can be hard, so they'll let you go to a different room. And so even when she went back to school, her 504 plan was very specific about where she sat in the classroom, needing to be like well ventilated, being able to go to the bathroom or eat if she needed to. Her teacher and her, they had a sign if she did something, because kids don't want to be different. They just want to go back to normal. And she went back to school about 3 weeks after she was done with treatment, which is wild when I think about it, full time, because she wanted to. And so they had their own little lingo, but you're able to put a ton of things into that. And I guess that would be the other advice. That's where, if you have other parents that you can ask, because the one thing, probably the most important thing that I've learned, is to ask questions, because there isn't a one size fits all, especially in the sarcoma space, or you have to ask. So for Gracie specifically, the two chemos that she had long-term can cause heart failure. They can cause infertility. They can cause kidney issues. So right now, she just transitioned like officially over to survivorship, but her scans are now every 6 months. So she sees her team in June and then the survivorship team. So she has echocardiograms to manage, or to check on her heart, really. And how frequent those are based on the dosage of doxorubicin that she received. So they do blood work, looking for all the things, quite honestly, like her A1C for diabetes. They have a dietitian, how she eats, which is really hard with a kid. That's another place where I would say give yourself grace. Our team has always said, do the good and the bad. It's really hard with kids to just live a very strict diet. So, you know, they help in that way. And then making sure exercise, they kind of just give you all the things that you need to do to prevent as much as you can.
You mentioned that you're in therapy, Gracie's in therapy. I don't think that mental health is talked about enough. And so I'm curious to know where you're being treated and the programs that they had, they offered it. Did you seek it out on your own? And at what stage of the journey did you realize maybe this is something that we could do that could help us?
For Gracie specifically, they have a psychologist on their team. Her second round of chemo, she was having pain. And what I didn't know at the time is it was a panic attack. And so at one point, Grace was laying in the hospital bed, rolling back and forth, screaming, I don't want to die. At that point, I was like, we need to do something. She started very early in the journey, and she did it very frequently, probably through until like a year off of treatment, and which was really good. Because the other thing that for kids too, it's like everybody's lives move on. So when she got reintroduced into society, I had the same problem. There was different groups of friends, and you are in a situation and people are talking about vacations and all these things, and you have nothing to add to the conversation. You're like, I've been living in a hospital and I'm still afraid my child's going to die, or, you know, Grace is speaking on her behalf. So it actually really helped her navigate that part of it too, which is a young 9-10 year old girl in 5th and 6th grade. It's all drama. That was really helpful for her. And then for me, gosh, I wish I had done it sooner. I had the moment when she was done where, quite honestly, I was like, how am I going to pay for everybody to be in therapy? I didn't even know how to do it. And I went on our insurance and started to look, and it was so overwhelming to me that, again, going back to how wonderful our team is, I went to our social worker. And they're like the unsung heroes. I mean, what you know of social worker and then social workers like this, I mean, she did so many incredible things for our family. And luckily for us, there's a foundation local who provides free counseling. So I started myself there. And then I had to go back to work. And then at one point I called my mom and I was like, I don't think I'm okay. I think I may need to go somewhere, because all I could think about was her dying. And by happenstance, I found a woman. I was actually on Facebook, which is kind of ridiculous. And it was like one of those meant to be moments. And I had heard about doing EMDR. And I was like, I think I need to do that. And so I reached out. And ironically, the woman who I ended up seeing, her daughter had cancer. And she was 6 years post treatment. And it has been like incredible, because going back to that piece where no one understands, I just want to hug her every time I walk out of there. And initially I tried to do EMDR and we did it once, and it emotionally took me down for days. And I came back the next week and she was like, I think we need to talk longer. And so we talked for a few months. It's a lot to process. And then we went back to it. And I think no matter at what point, if you choose to do that, I will say I'm really glad I did, because it enabled me to look at them with a different perspective. Wish I had done it earlier. I waited too long. You got to have an outlet to allow yourself to feel. I mean, I would be randomly driving to Target and just start crying. You need to allow yourself the space to feel, which is hard to do, you know?
It is really hard, Jenny. And I think it's great that you were able to find a supportive therapy practice that works for you and works for your family. And speaking of support, I want to go back to the survivorship program.
I'm curious about what the survivorship program is.
So for our hospital specifically, the longer you go without cancer, they start to transition you to the survivorship team. I want to say at 18 months was our first appointment, and she had a virtual appointment. And the cool thing is, the doctor who was on this team realized that they were missing something, that the journey really wasn't fully 360. And so I met her actually in the hospital when Grace was going into treatment, started with more natural ways to deal with anxiety and things like that. And then, like I said, there is a specific dietitian. There's a child life resource for school. There's a psychology aspect to it. You see the oncologist or the nurse practitioner. And so their main goal is to help you with the long-term side effects. So obviously the oncology doctors need to see the people who need to be seen. So it's a nice transition to help them learn to eat in a way as a kid as best they can, do the things. They talk about supplements. So for her, like fish oil, omega-3s for her heart, magnesium, things like that. So it just kind of helps them do the things as best they can to prevent the things from happening. And they also monitor fertility and those types of things.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think the topic of supporting survivors, that's a necessary part of cancer treatment, is at least more commonly discussed now. So it's really interesting to hear of an institution that has an established program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They do groups for the kids. So they have like tween groups where you're in treatment or you're closer to off treatment and the kids all get together. Ironically, when Gracie did it, they hadn't brought it back because of COVID. And so our social worker was nice enough to let, she was kind of past the point of really needing to be included, but also like Gracie really loved it because she was with people who understood what she had been through without her saying it. So they went and did really fun things together and there were kids in treatment. I mean, but once you're in survivorship, they transition you until you get adult hospital. So we'll see people like who are 20, 21, 22. I'm not exactly sure the age cutoff. So that's what I love about it's consistency of care too. So your oncology people are there if you need them. It's all in the same clinic too, which is great. So we still get to go and see all of our friends that we love. It's a great program. And I realized too, and some of the moms, it's funny, there's a big group of us Instagram moms on the back end connected and we're all great resources for each other. But that's what I think I've also learned that between social workers and survivorship, there's definitely a gap. And we have definitely been on the lucky end of having really great people for both.
Yeah. And I think some programs don't have the social workers and the navigators and the survivorship programs, but we've said this before. That's why we give out our Compassionate Care Award at our Stand Up to Sarcoma Gala, that we ask the community to nominate their navigator or their social worker, because we know that they play such a significant role and they make a huge difference. It's such an impact for the families and for the patients. And the relationships that they develop with the social workers is like the ones they develop with their medical oncologists.
Mm-hmm. Well, ours specifically really treated us as a family. And I feel like our doctors, that's why we love our hospital. I mean, they felt like family, but they genuinely didn't just care about Gracie. I mean, when Gracie was diagnosed, Child Life invited Jackson and Gracie and they walked them around clinic and let them see, you know, and talk to them in age appropriate ways. And, you know, our social worker also, your child is immunocompromised. You can't go to the park. They had someone come. We didn't have a playset in our backyard because there's one up in the neighborhood, but we couldn't necessarily go there. So they had a foundation, Rock Solid, who's awesome, build, you know, one in our backyard. And they give you a folder of resources, you know, financial. I mean, that was the other thing I realized that a lot of people don't do. I mean, day one, it's like, here's a folder and you don't necessarily know what it all means. I was like, why are you giving me this? But I mean, it's financial resources, it's wigs, it's, you know, things for your kids. It's all kinds of stuff. And I've actually made a copy and given it to other people because they don't have it. Where we were, they do a really incredible job.
What is one thing, not just your experience, but in terms of treatment, in terms of research, in terms of those types of things, what would you want other people to know?
I mean, for sarcoma specifically, I think what you guys have created, I actually wish I had found your website sooner because of the resources that you have listed. I don't think people know that there's sarcoma centers and they don't realize how detrimental misdiagnosis could be. I mean, I know for me, even in the waiting to find out what Gracie had, I at one point called her doctor, I mean, hysterically crying. I don't understand. Just get it out. You can figure out like whatever else you need to do later, but get it out. And I remember him saying to me, well, depending on what it is how much we're going to have to do, even in surgery. And so having we could have had a misdiagnosis. They would have, where her tumor was, they would have done radiation, which her heart was right behind. I think that that's, with sarcoma, time is of the essence and it's so important. But I think that's the most important thing I can tell someone and to get a second opinion.
We always ask as well because of the community aspect of sarcoma. It's a very strong community of people. It's also a community of people that feel isolated with the nature of having a rare disease. So we always ask our guests, if someone wanted to connect with you after the podcast, as part of that community, where can they find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. You can also find me on Instagram. My handle is J Goodman Sage, and I'm sure you guys will link it.
We'll link it.
Or also on Facebook, and I think I sent my email. So I'm pretty accessible if you'd like to reach out.
Amazing. And any last message you want to share with listeners?
Yeah, just do something. Do something to help our community. It's really important, and a lot of lives depend on it.
It's a great message to end on. Well, Jenny.
All right. Well, thank you so much of your time today.
Thanks so much, you guys.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners. To amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients, SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link.